please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It is Billy F. from Schwanksville, who just celebrated yesterday.
Hey everybody, my name is Billy, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And it's overwhelming to be up here in front of this many people. I'm used to speaking in front of like 20, 30 people. So I don't usually prepare for these kinds of things. I just kind of shoot a prayer up and ask that, you know, God kind of speak through me. I stay honest. I don't try to sound profound or try to drop any knowledge. I just kind of share my experience of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. I guess to start from the beginning, I grew up in a sober household. My father got sober when I was, 3 years old. And I grew up in Limerick, Pennsylvania, about 45 minutes away from here. And a house with 4 sisters and no brothers. My perception of my childhood was probably a lot worse than it really was. Growing up, I felt like I got dealt a bad hand, and the girls were favored. And, you know, Dad was always working, Mom was always working too, and then at night Dad was always at his meetings, and I was kind of left to fend for myself. And, you know, it was always rough for me being around all those girls. But earliest recollection of drinking, I didn't actually think about it until I heard my little sister share her story one time. She's 10 years sober next year. And we were sitting around the kitchen table with my older sisters and my cousins. Mom and Dad were away, and the girls were throwing a party. And they were practicing shots, and they were sitting around the table, and my older sister was gulping these things down, and my cousin, I think, was betting her that, I bet your little brother and sister can do them better than you. And of course, she said, you know, let's find out, and we just proceeded to bang back a few shots, and I was probably 10, I think she was like 8, and I can't tell you if I felt anything or anything happened, but I know when that house filled full of people and they were singing and dancing, and I was sitting on the counter, and I was just like taking it all in, because I never really experienced this stuff. And you know, around the holidays we'd visit some family members and they would be pounding beers, and that was like my only real exposure to alcohol. And but when I was at this, in the middle of this party, I'm like, I want this. This is what I want. And that was my goal. And my only problem is my sisters were good, man. They never got caught. And they were slick. Anytime I tried something, Mom and Dad would go away. There were 6 local cops, 3 stadies, and a canine unit in the driveway. Yes, the local police knew me pretty well. And I think I was always grounded too, and from early on, like I think my sisters paved the way with all their craziness, that they just figured they'd keep their foot on me from the get-go. So, you know, they kept trying to keep me down, and I was very rebellious, and a lot of sneaking out, a lot of drinking. Booze was my thing, and a lot of car wrecks before the ages, you know. 17th birthday, I was in a really bad car accident. People were medevaced. People were really badly hurt, and I was so drunk I'd walked away from it. And I remember my father, you know, they couldn't do nothing to me in the hospital until they had parents' consent, and I told my dad I was going fishing real early, you know, the police are calling to say they got, you know, the hospital's got your son, you need to come up and see him. And I just remember that he came up and he walked in the emergency room, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and he just walked in, and he said, "Happy birthday, son," and he turned around and he walked out. And you know, he never told me he was going to take me to AA, but he always said he was going to save me a seat. And I never liked that. And and he always said, "Son, I believe this disease that I have is hereditary." He said, My father had it. Your Aunt Kitty had it, which was his older sister, and she died from this disease at 55, I think. It was around that time. And my Uncle John, who we just buried earlier this year at the age of 55. And I think Aunt Kitty had 3 years in AA at one time. And I believe my Uncle John had about 14 years. And he went from having the mansion on the main line with the maid and all the trimmings to living in a mission in Chester, pretty washed out in the end. And I always tell my, that's a reminder to me that, you know, I could be on my game today, but down the road I could end up like Uncle John. You know, I'm from that same blood. That's just my belief, and that was my father's belief, and he'd always say that, and I told myself, and I'm not like them, you know what I mean? And there was such static between me and Pop. You know, he threw me out around 18. I was just getting out of hand, and my whole thing was like, I'll show him. I don't need them, you know, and I went off to find myself, or to do makes, you know, just find my own way, and somehow I ended up in Michigan, and I worked in an working in a hotel in Valley Forge for a little while. Ran into an outfit that it was a seasonal property in Michigan on Mackinac Island, and you got Michigan here, and then you got the Upper Peninsula, and then Canada, and then there's this little right in between. There's this little dot. It's called Mackinac Island. And there's nothing on this island except bicycles, horses, and bars. No cars. They said it was timeless. And I'll tell you what, I was on this island for 5 years, and I had no idea what the hell was going on in the outside world. And I never watched TV or anything, but it was... I moved up to this place in 96, and I was 20 years old, and I moved into a dorm with 300 English, Irish, and Scottish students that were studying hospitality from overseas, and we were stuffed in this little co-ed dorm, and it was probably like a 5x9 room that I had for 5 years, and we worked 80 to 100 hours a week around the clock, and, you know, I was, when people talk about a lot of insecurities, I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and I needed everyone's approval. I needed to be recognized, needed to be seen, and I was always striving to be ahead of the pack, you know, and I needed all those awards and stuff like that to validate my self-worth, And I worked hard, but while I was up there, you know, work hard, play hard. That was my motto. And living in resort towns and stuff like that, everybody was partying, you know. They would, you know, everybody takes a week vacation to kick back and party. Well, that was like every day for me. I worked in through parties. We were in the banquet department. You know, we do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, and dinner time we'd be serving drinks and stuff like that, and after dinner we'd finish off all the rest of the drinks, and then we'd run down to the dorm, and I'd stop and drink with the Scottish kids, and I'd stop with the Irish kids, and I'd be trashed by the time I got back to my room. Throw some clothes on, run out front, steal a bike, and ride downtown. Downtown the drinking wasn't just like beers and stuff. You bought fish bowls of liquor. You get a fishbowl Long Island iced tea, there'd be 6 straws in it, and you just take it to the table, and everybody just stick their head, and you don't stop till it's empty. And that's how we drank every night. I blacked out every night. My drinking in my teens and stuff was weekends here and there scattered. The blackouts didn't really come until I had made it to this island, and it was 5-6 nights a week. And then I would come 2 in the morning, we'd go up about 2 hours sleep. We drag each other out of bed, and roll off to work. I probably wouldn't eat. It was coffee and smokes till like noon because I couldn't hold. My hangovers were insane, and I walked around in like an alcoholic haze. Boss man would always be like, you know, just stay away from the guests for a while, you know. And I reeked. I was one of those guys. I couldn't understand it. Like, I'm partying with these guys and they're somewhat functioning. You know, for me, I could take a shower, scrub my teeth. Once I start running around, like, the booze comes out of me. You can smell me across the room. And I was like the walking dead. And I was 120 pounds for many years. And but that's how my life was. And I'd be running around at work and I'd fall down here and there. And just collapse, get concussions. They sent me down to the med center, and I was, you know, I thought there was something seriously wrong with me, and like a tumor or something like that. And the doctor's, you know, he's like, son, how much do you drink? And I said, not any more than anybody else on this island. And he said, there's nothing in you, you know, you need to get more fluids in you. He's like, you're dehydrated. You're just, you know, once you start running around, you know, there's nothing in you. Just gonna, you know, it's going to keep happening, you know. And, you know, I was pretty sickly. And, you know, going back to the resort, didn't think much about it. Everybody's like, what happened? What's wrong with you? And I'm like, yeah, they told me I party too hard, you know. And I was like, oh, you know, that's great. And, you know, it was like a badge of honor. You know, I hear people talk about that. And it didn't stop me. And, you know, for me, up there, I was safe on this island. You know, we drink to oblivion. You come out of the bar. And if you couldn't walk, they put you in a cart and they push you home. And they put you in bed. And I was there for five summers and two winters. And in the winter time, they'd normally send us to different resorts and stuff like that. So, which was kind of like getting back into reality for me. And every time they sent me somewhere new, I told myself it was going to be different, you know. They sent me to Key West in 96. You know, I told myself I'm going to put a little bit of weight back on. I'm going to start eating again. Yeah, slow down the booze. Nah, you know. Went back to the island. And then they sent me out to Wisconsin. Used to be Hugh Hefner's first Playboy Mansion back in the 60s. And they put us out in the bunny huts out there. And it was just, had all kinds of stories of this place. And me and a friend from the island, we went out drinking one night. And I drove. And I drank like I always drank on the island. I drank like I drank every night. And we're sitting at the bar and just everything kind of faded into the usual blackout. And, you know, I woke up the next morning and I couldn't move my arm. Didn't have my truck. I'd stolen a tow truck. Because I got my truck apparently stuck. It was in the middle of a blizzard. And I think I got my truck stuck in a snowdrift and we conveniently borrowed someone's tow truck. And did a little time for that. And calling mom and dad from jail in Wisconsin, not knowing what happened. I broke my arm good enough to get a titanium plate and six screws in it. Listening to mom cry on the phone, not really realizing that she's like reliving all this, that she went through a pot with me. And my relationship with my dad for years was, you know, I'd call and he's like, what happened? And I'm like, I don't know. How much do you need? Need about $3,500 for a lawyer. I'll put it on your tab. And that was our relationship. And then I'd go back to work. I'd get that money first thing and I'd send it to him. That way I'd be like, you know, clean slate. You know, I don't ever like to owe him. But he was always like my, you know, fail safe. And for me, listening to the mom crying, like putting her through that, I told her, man, I gotta get a handle on this, man. It's getting bad. And for me drinking, I didn't drink in the mornings. I didn't wake up to booze. Okay, I thought I was kind of responsible. You know, I waited till like a good hour in the evening, but I didn't really notice it. But like when I hit the bar, or I'd order like two doubles. You know, like rum and coke. I drank Captain Morgan for years, and when I broke my arm, I was like, I got to change this up. So I switched to Bacardi Light, and thought that would do the trick. I read about that later in that big book, and I would do that many times. I switched to beer, and I'm blacking out on Bud Light, and then wine was a real bad idea. Like, I never had hangovers like I did with, like, Merlot. So I thought I was fancy for a while and I was drinking Merlot. But I quit drinking after Wisconsin. I'm like, that's it. And I went back to the island and I went to the bar every night, drank Coke with a lime, you know, and was doing good at work too. I was on time every day, you know, and met a girl from Liverpool, England, and we fell in love, and we moved in, and we shared a room together. Can't say we moved in together, but and we'd go out drinking, and she would be like, "Billy, how come you never have a glass of wine with me or something like that?" You know, and you know, she never seen me drink, and I told her, and I showed her. I'm like, "Baby, I got scars all over my body, and I got no stories to go with it." And that was my thing, from the concussions, like stitches, my car accidents, my legs are all scarred up, and I never, you know, I just wake up and I'd be like wounded. That's how I was. And for whatever reason, I wasn't at the bar. We were at home, and I was feeling romantic, and I had a glass of wine with this girl, and I only had one. You know, and then the next night I had a bottle of Zinfandel with her, and then a couple nights later, me and the boys had a case of beer, and then she ran for the hills, and I was heartbroken, and I was oblivion after that for a while, and I stayed on the island that winter. And if you've ever seen the movie The Shining, that's what this place is like. The snow's up to your chest, it's 50 below wind chill coming off the lake. I was only working 8-hour shifts because I think the whole winter we were just scraping the grout out of like all the bathrooms and re-grouting it, and it was just a skeleton crew, and I just drank, you know. All I knew was working and drinking, and so I'm not working a whole lot, so just left plenty of time for drinking, you know, it was nuts, and I did two winters there, and it was time for me to go, and my boss, I don't know, he strung me along, like I was his sidekick, and he was food and beverage director up there, and I worked my way up to banquet manager, and he said, "All right, you know, I'm heading down to Panama City Beach, I got a big job down there, there's a spot for you, you know, we're a team, come on with me." And I'm thinking the same thing I was thinking, a fresh start, new beginning, you know. Panama City Beach, spring break capital of the United States. It'll be good. So I went down there and I got an apartment, you know, right next to Club La Vila and the MTV house, you know, and the Girls Gone Wild house was over here. And I was in the middle of it. But the work thing, you know, I was in my head. It was the big time for me down there, and managing people. I was never very, you know, I was a manager. I was supposed to manage people, and dealing. I was more of a control freak than a manager. I tried to control people, and I'd set such high expectations on people, and they just didn't quite meet them. And I had to drink over people constantly, but that's, you know, it was like, to me, I'm like, all right, I'm a director. That was my title. How fitting. Director of catering, you know. And I had an apartment two blocks from the most beautiful beaches in the United States. Had a truck that was paid for. Everything was paid for. Beautiful furniture, all the toys. You know, I understand these people. I suffer from the disease of more. Like, I was miserable, you know. The TV wasn't big enough. Nothing was ever good enough. You know, people talk about that God-shaped hole. I had a God-shaped hole in me, and I tried to fill it with girls, with booze, drugs, everything, and I was losing my mind. And I was working down there. It was 6 months straight, no days off. And I was getting bad. I was falling down again, getting stitches in my head, and the same routine. And then one night after work, boss man told me, "Go home, don't come into work tomorrow. Just take it easy, you know, we got you covered." And I'm like, all right, so I'm already half lit leaving work. I go out and proceed to drink a little bit more. Coming home, 2 blocks from my house, my truck flips over on its side and it's spinning. And then when it stopped, I jumped out the passenger door and there's a woman laying next to my truck. And there was somebody already standing there. And she's like, man, she's gone. And so I jumped off my truck. And, you know, the first minute, you know, the first thing, it's just like, it's over. It's done. Everything's done. It's all gone. And then I just went and sat on the side of the road and waited for him to come get me. And I was just numb. And I looked up the street and there was a guy moving around a little bit. And his motorcycle was smashed halfway up the road. And he died on the way to the hospital. So the cops took me to the hospital, took my blood, and they let me go. And then 6 months later, they charged me with 2 counts of DUI manslaughter. And, you know, I can't really tell you what that was like. By the question whose fault the accident was, he was loaded out of the bar, picked this girl up, you know. Everybody at work was like, Billy, you know, it wasn't your fault. He hit you. And that's all I needed to say. I just needed an excuse, you know. And I didn't, you know, it was 2 weeks and I was drinking again. And that happened in May of 2001. And I proceeded to stay totally polluted for like a year. And just went to work. We'd go to hearings, like hungover, you know. Like they keep putting it off a month. You know, I got an attorney and I was just in an alcoholic haze. I mean, there was no point the way I was looking at it. And I remember one time my one sister called, and I must have been in a blackout, and she must have been yelling at me. The next morning, like, you know, my other sister called me. She was screaming at me, you know, like, what are you doing, you know. And, hey, they're up in Pennsylvania. I'm down here, you know, in Florida, just wasting away and just getting ready to get put away. And you know, and to say that, you know, when I drink, I black out. And all ability of reason goes out the window. And I was driving all the time, you know. And this, it was after like a, I did that for about a year. And after it was like a 3-day bender, like something clicked, like, you know, I'm going to kill somebody else. And then they're going to really drop the hammer. And so I called my pop, and he said, son, I've been waiting a long time for you to, you know, call me with this, and I just wish, you know, you hadn't waited this long. But he said, I told him I'm going to go to one of them damn meetings, and he said, I want you to do something. Because work sent me one time before up on the island. It was like once a week, and there were 3 people there, and it wasn't much, and I didn't really get an AA experience. But when I called him, he said, I want you to do 2 things. He said, one, I want you to get a sponsor, and one that you ain't going to manipulate and work your ways with, one that's going to, you know, kick your butt and keep you in line. And he said, 2, you got to stay away from them girls. And I said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. It's spring break, you know. And he said, we'll try, you know. And so I crawled into a meeting, you know. It was a noontime meeting. And I went in there, and I kind of sat there, figured I'd just listen to what everybody said, hear what I got to hear, and get out. And I sit down and asked if there was any newcomers, and everybody just kind of turned and like looked at me, and I just sat there like, how do they know that I've never been here before? You know? And then everybody kind of shared, and there was this guy. He was big, and he was from Brooklyn. And he looked like Jesse Ventura, and that's how I describe him. And he was mean. He was an ex-biker. His Harley was parked out front, and he, Vietnam vet, you know, he was rough. And I went up to him after the meeting. I said, I, you know, hi, I'm Billy. I said, I need a sponsor. And he goes, yes, so. And I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. And he said, there's some things you need to do, though, boy. And Right from the beginning, this man administered some serious ego deflating. And he said, I want you to be here every day for this 12 o'clock meeting. I said, you don't understand. I'm a pretty important guy down the street at this resort. And I don't know if I can make it here every day. And he said, boy, if you don't get here every day, there aren't going to be no job to go back to. Mm-hmm. He reads the papers. He knew who the heck I was. And I was all over the paper down there. And he said, you're going to come here every day and help me make coffee, 11 o'clock. And you're going to call me every day. And the next day I came in, 11 o'clock, he was sitting in there with his arms folded. Where you been? And I'm like, you said 11 o'clock? And he's like, you got to beat me here. And so 11 o'clock turned to 11:45, turned into 11:30. You know, 11:45 is I'm locked at the door. 11:30, I catch him. And I called him the first 2 days. The third day, he called me. Is your phone broke, boy? And I'm like, I just forgot, you know. He's like, don't forget. He's like, you know, you got to call me. And we were talking, and it's like, what are you doing today? What are you doing tonight? And I was like, that's it. I'm like, we're talking for like 2 minutes. Like, what's the point of me calling you every day? And he's like, you just got to check in with me every day. I got to know where you're at. And this guy, Leo, I'll tell you what, he saved my butt. He gave me a big book, and he told me to read it. And I read the doctor's opinion, and he told me to read that for like the first week. And then I'm reading this doctor's opinion, and it's talking about that phenomenon of craving. And I got this allergy, and I'm like, this kind of makes some sense to me. Like, I was wondering, like, I couldn't have figured this out myself, you know. And I think back about the times when, like, during the day, like, if I snuck a couple drinks at lunch, like, and I'd, like, fight off drinking, because I know I wouldn't, you know, if I keep drinking, like, I was going to, like, wreck my day at work. But, like, I'd hold off till, like, after, like, towards the end of dinner time, and I'd be freaking out, you know. And like, once I took that first drink, that switch was flipped, man, and I can't stop. And so many times I've said, I'm only going to go have two, you know. I'm only going to drink Bud Light. I'm going to leave at 9 o'clock, you know. I'd say that every time I went out, you know, and then every morning I wake up with the guilt, shame, and remorse, you know, and the book had, it was explaining what was wrong with me, you know, and I got to the part about the director, you know, and how he likes to arrange the lights, you know, the way he likes them. It's everybody would just do whatever he, you know, just if everybody act the way they were supposed to, the way I want them to, everything would just be great, you know. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, that's me, you know. And that's like that whole, like, wow, I'm like, no regular guy, like, wrote this book, you know. To me, it was like something greater than, you know, was working through this guy and putting this on paper, you know. I had too many, like, there was no God in my life. I went to Catholic school 12 years. I got that ran down my throat. Altar boy. Mom drug me to church every Sunday. I hated that stuff. And I hated anything that had to do with that, you know. But whenever I'd get in them scrapes, and I honestly didn't believe in God. If I couldn't see him or touch him, I didn't believe, you know. It's for weak people that, you know, need something to believe in. And I found out later that was pretty true. But for me, like, I had these situations. Like, that winter time when I was up on the island, like, I had this, like, near-death experience, I guess you could call it. Like, me and this Indian guy jumped on a snowmobile, and we drove across the mainland. We had some island fever, drove about three miles across the ice to the mainland, and went to the casino because they gave you free booze when you're playing. So we got totally blasted, and I'm driving his snowmobile because the guy was drunker than me, and he was, like, 280. We're cruising back, and it's snowing. And I wrecked the snowmobile out, like, a mile out on the ice. And he's knocked out, and the snowmobile's on top of me. And I'm just like, God, please don't let me die out here. I'll never drink again. You know, like, those are the kind of, like, I don't know where it came from, because I don't believe in God, but all of a sudden, like, boom, I'm automatically praying. You know what I mean? And then this guy would come to, and he lifted the sled off me, And we went straight back to the resort and we kept on drinking. You know, that was my relationship with God, you know. And that would happen whenever I have them situations that were out of my control. I'd somehow be crying out, you know, to God. Just like when I was at the end when I called my pop. I was crying out to God, please help me. And I called my pop. But there was little things that were getting me believing, you know, when I came in, you know. There was this young kid. They were all, they call them snowbirds. They're all retirees from up north. They were retired down there in Panama City Beach. And they're all like from Michigan, Chicago, New York, and they got like 30 plus years, and I'm the only one getting sober down there, you know. And there was one other kid that was my age. He was 27, had 5 years sober. He kind of stayed away from me, you know, and he's kind of quiet guy. And one day I walked out my front door, and he walked out his front door, and we lived directly across the street from each other. Like, what are the odds of that, you know? And in the middle of all this insanity and partying, you know, I'd be at his house having coffee when I come home from work, or in the morning he'd come over and we'd have coffee and hang out and, like, you know, read out of the books and stuff like that, or just talk AA shop, or just talk about music or whatever. And, like, later on to me, that was one of them God things. To me, I was just, hey, what a coincidence, you know? There was a lot of them for me. And I'll tell you what, you know, Leo took me through the steps, and I managed to get a fourth and fifth in with him before they sent me away. And they worked out a deal in 2003. You know, they said 30 months in prison and 12 on paper. And I said, where do I sign? Because I'm not a good gambler. And for me to try to go all the way, you know, and lose in a trial, that's 30 years in prison. And May of 2003, they sent me off to Florida's finest prisons along the Alabama state line, and I worked on the chain gang. And I watched too many movies. I remember sitting on my couch watching Oz thinking, man, you know, I'm going to have to stab somebody as soon as I get in there or something. You know, fear of the unknown can really mess you up, you know, that whole projecting and stuff, man. But there were guys that did time. They'd sit down before I went away and they'd tell me, yeah, this is how it's like, this is what it's like, you know, and they kind of, you know, and I went in. And it was interesting. But Friday, the first Friday I was there, they called for AA on the yard. I'm like, here, this is where I make my stand, you know. Do I walk across the pound, you know? And I did it. I went, you know. And there was a guy sitting there, and he's like, he was happy to see me, you know. And he's the only guy there. And I sat down with him, and for many a week, it was just me and him. And I found out kind of later that this guy drove 2 hours from somewhere in the panhandle up to this prison to bring a meeting, and no one ever showed up. So he'd drive 2 hours, sit for an hour in the chow hall, and then drive home 2 hours. And I'm like, man, I would have just gave up on that a long time ago, you know. And it's pointless to me, but, you know, thinking about it, that guy hadn't just continually done that, you know, just being there in case someone showed up, you know. I don't know if I would have made it, you know. And to me, that's some, like, serious, when I think of service, like, I try to compare myself to that guy, you know, and sometimes I don't think I could ever come close, but I try. And for a year, it was me and him, you know, and just went through it. You know, it was a crash course, one day at a time. Waking up, the guy sent me my books, you know, through the mail, and I had my big book, my 12 and 12. They put me on the phone list. They said, don't worry about the collect calls, just call us, you know. And they'd drive 2 hours, Leo and his sponsor, Jerry, and they'd come up every month and visit me. And I got to know the guys on the pound, you know, and, you know, that's Tampa Bay country down there. And, you know, I was Philly. They called me Philly because I was that Eagles fan and I talked funny to them. And, and I'd be sitting there playing dominoes or whatever and they go, yo, Philly, they're calling for you. They're calling that AA, you know. And that's how it was. Like, people knew what I was in for and they knew I didn't drink, you know. I'd be out on the chain, and we'd be walking, you know, chopping down trees, and there'd be a six-pack of beer sitting in the ditch, like, listening at 6 a.m. in the dew, and boss man drives down the road, and everybody's looking around, and they're like, who's getting Philly's beer today? Because they knew I didn't drink, and that's kind of how it went. And, you know, it was real easy to get anything in there, just as easy down the street. And there was one time I worked at a recycling place for a little while, and I'm distributing, you know, sorting bottles and stuff, and here comes a half gallon of Bacardi Light. And I'm just like, and I'm just standing there, and the guy next to me is like, you gonna take that? And I said, no, and he drank it and got locked up. And, there is jail in jail, too. So, but, I'll tell you what, I don't think I'd still be sober today if I hadn't been put away. Some of us need to be removed from society, I think, for a while to really get it. And for me, I met so many young kids in there that killed their sister, their girlfriend, their best buddy, doing 15 years, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, why me, you know? Why not them, you know? And they were good kids, too, you know. It's just one of those nights. And, you know, they moved me off the work release in, I think it was like May of 2005. And they put me in this prison right by Panama City Beach. And they called for AA. And one thing I got to mention, like, a big thing for me when I was in my one camp, in the middle of the night they grabbed me, they threw me in a van, shackled me up, threw me in a van, took me back to Panama City Beach. Took me to this federal courtroom, put me in a suit, the one I was wearing before they locked me up, and they're walking me down the hall, and they're telling me, all right, here's the deal. The woman's family suing the guy's family, saying it was his fault, he hit you. They need your testimony, the civil suit, yada, yada, yada. I wasn't going to get off or nothing. It was just, they just needed my testimony. You can't say that you've been convicted of this crime. And I'm thinking, wow, here it is. Here's that chance, you know. I was wrongfully, you know, locked up, you know. And I went in there and they put me on the stand and they said, you know, tell us what happened, you know. And I don't know. I was honest, you know, like the first real time in my life. You know, and I told them, you know, I don't really know. I was pretty loaded. Did he come across and hit you? I'm like, I don't know. I can't tell you. And in my heart, I knew I contributed to that accident, you know. Even though I don't quite know what went down. And they didn't win. I'm pretty sure it had a lot to do with my lack of testimony, I guess you could say. But, you know, that was something I just wanted to point on. Like, it was one of them things, you know. I felt like I did the right thing for a change, you know what I mean? Anyway, I went to Panama City Work Release, and I called for AA, and I walked into this room, and there's Leo and Jerry. They turned around, they saw me, and they're like, because they didn't know I was coming, you know, like for security reasons, they don't let you know when they're transporting and where to. And it was one of those coincidences that I ended up at the prison that they take a meeting to, you know, every week. And I spent the last 3 months at a meeting a week with those guys, and then I was released July 4th, 2005, and they put me on a plane. Leo picked me up, and they put me on a plane, and he gave me a hug, and he said, I love you, kid. And that was, like, big for Leo, you know. And even today, they even, you know, I stay in touch with them today. But when I came back up here, you know, it was, when I got out, I saw the job. They're like, you know, you still got the job, buddy. The director title, the position, you know, the money. And I'm thinking, and they beat that whole people, places, and things in me. And I was just like, I can't. I knew I'd get drunk again, you know, and that was so scary for me because that's all I knew was to throw parties for a living. And so what do? I moved back in with Mom and Dad at the age of 31, back here in PA, and that was very humbling. And lived with them for a year, and came back and just jumped into AA. I got a new sponsor, Tim C., and he's the exact opposite of Leo, but he's just who I need in my sobriety today. And continued the steps with Tim. Did another fourth and fifth with him because I figured, you know, if he can help, if he's going to help, he really needs to know who he's dealing with. So I gave him the lowdown and the dirt on me, and we continued on with the steps. And for me, it was kind of tough for a while, you know. And I didn't date for a while. Well, I wasn't dating while I was, you know, first 2 years I wasn't dating because I was locked up. I wasn't trying to date. But I got out and I'm like, I got nothing to offer. I'm behind the eight ball, you know. I need to get my life in order, my act together. And they always told me, man, and they always sobriety too. I mean, it's selfish and self-centered to throw your sick ass self in somebody's life. You know what I mean? Your chaos and insanity. You need to get squared away before you get involved in somebody's life. Because that's just selfish, they told me, and we're not in that business today. And to me, I'm like, I got nothing to offer right now. I need to get my act together, you know. And it was just means, and like hanging out with guys, worrying about, you know, where's my life at? You know, is this gonna be it? They just don't worry about it, kid. Just keep going to meetings, you know. Keep reaching out, you know. Got a coffee commitment up here. Got a new home group, Schwanksville Basic AA, and. You know, start sponsoring guys, you know, and that's a whole other thing in itself, and for me. But I got a job offer at this place, and out of nowhere, somebody knew somebody, and they said, why don't you come interview? So I went in, application, filling it out. I got a 3-year gap in there. Felony charges, yeah, and you know, put it all down there, you know. And then they looked it over and they asked me about stuff, and I told them straight up. And I told them I was sober and this and that, and I left. I didn't think I got the job. They called me back. They hired me. And at this point, I live with another guy in AA, and right there in town, in Collegeville Trap, and Septa bus goes right past there, and it just happened to go on a route that went right by this place of work. So I had transportation there, and I had a job, and went into this place. I was like a telemarketer for a while, and after a year, they promoted me to a sales position. And when I was there for the first year, I remember went out with the team for lunch, you know, and we all go out to lunch, and we sit in the restaurant, and I go to the bathroom, and I come back, and there's beers all around the table. And nobody knows me. They don't know nothing about me. And they're like, we didn't know what to get you. You know, what do you want? Beer or something like that? I said, I'm just going to have a Coke. And they're like, nah, seriously, you know, you want something to drink? I said, dude, if I have a drink, man, we ain't going back to work. and everybody starts to laugh, and then I laugh, and they stop laughing, and I'm just kind of still laughing. and they don't ask anymore, you know? And AA kind of, you know, taught me that kind of stuff. And they taught me how to live amongst people. And I don't put myself in them situations. You know, I don't go hanging out places like that. We went out for lunch, and it was like a team building thing. But after a while, people got to know that Billy don't drink. And after a while, some of the comments and stuff I made, they kind of figured out that Billy probably used to drink, and he used to get in a lot of trouble. And they thought I lost my license for only a little while. Well, now it's like 3 years later, and I'm still not driving. And they know that Billy did something pretty bad. But they don't get too personal. I still have relationships with these people. And they're friends. And they don't know that I'm an AA, you know. And they don't know. And I must be doing something. I guess I might be a half-decent example of this program. Because there'll be people at work come up to me and say, I know you don't drink. I know you must have done something wrong, Ben. I have a son, or I have a brother, or I have a boyfriend, and I'm just like, whoa. Like, and then we go have lunch, and then I talk to them a little bit about my experience. I don't throw it all out there, but enough to let them know that I know that, you know, there is a solution, and there is a way out, and there is some hope. And I'm thinking, you know, and I ended up in this job. I make a heck of a lot more money than I did in those resorts. Worked half as many hours, you know. I made enough there at that place to pay off. I had $30,000 in restitution, funeral expenses. paid it off this past September. It took my license forever. And they said after this year, well, they told me this year was going to be my year. I'd be driving, but I guess it's not in the cards right now. But they told me 2010, you know, I'd be half my parole that I've served, and I could probably squash that and get my license. So that's one of them beyond my wildest dreams that they've been talking about. Some of us, it takes a little longer to get there, but that's just, I guess, the message that some of us have to carry. And I don't think, you know, I was hoping to be driving this year, and I just, you know, it's just one of the things, I guess God's, you know, I'm not ready to be leashed out onto the world, you know. But it's been a pretty amazing journey, you know. And for me, working with the newcomer today is where it's at for me. And I'm like growing just in that, you know. Like once I started working with others, like I started to grow more, because patience and tolerance is one of those things I got to work on. And working with newcomers, you know, I forget, like, I was like that too, and I get so frustrated, and I'm a meeting maker guy, you know, and I can get kind of ornery and get on. I can only transmit it, you know, the way it was given to me, so I'm like a little Leo sometimes of these guys, and it doesn't come off too good, but it's a learning experience for me, and I got a lot of good friends. I got a relationship with my father today, and that I never thought would be possible, you know. I gotta mention too, after 4 years or so, I was pretty set in my job. I met a girl, and she was in AA, and we dated for about 2 months, and you know, everything was just falling into place for me, you know. And then the girl's just like, all right, I don't want this anymore, you know, and then she left. And for me, it was like I had this feeling. It's like one of those times, like that heartache. I hadn't felt it in a long time, you know what I mean? Like that relationship thing, it can mess you up, you know. I'm supposed to be 5 years sober, and I got myself together, and I'm like a mess, you know. I knew this girl 2 months. And I knew that feeling, that heartache, that pain. And I knew, I'm like, this is when I really get loaded. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is freaky, man. And I had to talk to people about it, you know, and talk to my sponsor. And I started, and they tell you that nothing assures, you know, sobriety other than like working with a fellow alcoholic, man. You know, I started getting back into the steps with some more newcomers, and my sponsees in particular, and you know, got back on my ninth step and started making amends, because that all got sidelined, you know, and sitting down with mom at the kitchen table, you know, you want to plan it. I couldn't just really plan it, you know, and I told myself it'll happen when it's going to happen. And one day I was at the house and dad wasn't there for dinner. I just popped in, and we were at the table, and we were talking about dad, and how for some reason we're talking about Pop and his drinking back in the day, and then started to kind of roll into my drinking, and then it kind of rolled into me crying and bawling my eyes out and making amends to my mom. I was a mess, I hadn't cried in years. I was just a shell for years. Like, there was no emotion. So you get sober, and then, like, you get all these emotions and stuff back. And she looked across the table, and she said, son, all is forgiven. And it was just, like, one of them, like, moments, you know. It's freeing. If you haven't done that stuff, man, yet, you know, you got to get on it. You know, to me, when the pain is great enough, you know, you'll do some work. And the pain was great, and it kicked me back into doing what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, because I can get complacent, you know. And that's why I surround myself with a lot of good guys. I have some friends up here. I thought they were here to support me, but they're probably here to administer some ego deflating when we walk out of here. bring me back down. But they keep me in check. And Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and you know, it is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, and I couldn't have planned my life to be any. I don't have any of that material stuff today, you know. I found out it ain't about that stuff, you know, and because I had that stuff and I was a mess, and I, you know, working with others and helping other guys, you know, come back to life, you know, gives me that feeling that I used to chase in the bottle. And there's, you know, I could go on, but I won't. I think I said enough. And thank you all for being here and help me get another day sober.